All humans have a general tendency to avoid trying to do anything unfamiliar. And it's not because we're evil, it's not because we're incurious, it's just because we're familiar with something. It worked for us, it's gotten us to where we are.
This is What Now, the latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones, partners and co-founders of Ludic and the co-authors of the best-selling books Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, and The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to the What Now Ludic Insights podcast, Series 2. This series focuses on exploring the most influential perspectives and conversations on the current and future trends that are affecting the way we live, work, and learn. What now? Since the huge pivot to digital-enabled life in 2020 as a result of the global pandemic, what now for individuals, society, and business? What now for healthcare, finance, engineering, energy, marketing, travel, aerospace, manufacturing, technology? What now in the multiverse and the omnichannels and the inspiring, incredible, astonishing story of being human in the 21st century? The question is the answer, we think, and my name is Garrick Jones, and I'm joined by my fellow Ludic partner, Paul Ashcroft, today.
Hi there.
And in this episode, we are delighted to welcome Larry Keeley. Hi, Larry.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be with you and Paul, Garrick. Thank you.
Yeah, Larry, you're a renowned innovation scientist, co-founder, former president of Dublin Inc., an innovation strategy firm I've known for a long time, and you're one of my heroes, Larry, I have to say that. And it's always a pleasure to work with you. You've been known for pioneering comprehensive systems that materially improve innovation success rates. You got that right. And you were a former director at Deloitte, and you've been named by Bloomberg Businessweek as one of the 7 innovation gurus who are changing the field. And specifically, they cited Dublin for having many of the most sophisticated tools for delivering innovation effectiveness. I can't think of a better person to ask the question of what now. In 2010, Larry was selected as one of the 27 most influential designers in the world. Larry, what now?
Oh, good golly, Garrick. You have such an expansive view of questions in this podcast. I love it. I mean, it's really interesting to ask the question of what's happening with our species, what's happening with these times we live in, and what's coming next. And I think, to a very large extent, Garrick, one of the things that's interesting is that COVID has upstaged all the other urgent stories that are changing the planet, changing life as we know it, and hydraulically pressuring the need for change, the sense of velocity, urgency, and scope of change that we now have to confront. So what an amazing time to be alive.
Absolutely. What you're saying is that there are all these things kind of going on in the background underneath, and COVID is masking taking a lot of our attention, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. But these things are going on, and there is something transforming in the way that we live, work, and engage with life and the planet, mm-hmm. and so on. What do you believe are the big trends that we should pay attention to, Larry?
Well, obviously, global warming. I think if we didn't have COVID stealing the headlines constantly and forcing politicians everywhere to truncate their agendas to focus predominantly on the healthcare crisis, we'd be better able to see the extraordinary existential threat that global warming now presents. Certainly, nobody can escape the news of the weird weather that we're having everywhere in the world. And so what I think is the case now, Garrick, and maybe you and Paul see it differently, is that for one of the most interesting phenomena that I pay attention to is that I think to a very large extent, regular human beings are way ahead of the politicians on the awareness that global warming is just the shaping force of our time. And yet, we really do need politicians to rise to the occasion. We really need to change practices, and we need to finally get serious about things like re-engineering complex systems in the world and how we deal with the most costly ways that we live.
Larry, you said at the top that the pandemic is overshadowing many of the megatrends that are affecting and shaping how we're we're living and experiencing our planet. What do you think is emerging from the pandemic that you think are some of the big bets that we should pay attention to? And are they accelerating or decelerating some of the changes they need to happen around global warming, for example?
I think that they're just completely independent from the changes related to global warming, Paul, to a degree that they should not be. But certainly, as we've all learned how to work from home in the main, except for those segments of society that simply can't because their work is physical and in person, that's accelerated our adoption of technologies, our ability to have a different way of making a living. And I don't think that will ever completely return to normal. And that's a good thing. That's a really great thing that the world learned to adapt so quickly. We've learned to travel less, which is interesting because there's now a pent-up demand for people to do pleasure travel and to reassert their chances to be with the people that they love in the places that they love. But we've learned how to reinvent work so that we don't have to travel quite so much. And that's a great thing. It's shocking to me, a person who has, 14 million miles on American Airlines, 3 million miles on United Airlines. I'm said to be in the top 0.2% of global travelers. I didn't get on an airplane for a year. And then I only got on three flight segments for 4 months. And I've kind of enjoyed that. It's been fascinating to be able to see the degree to which we can still do the things we're trying to do as well as possible, even though it's often frustrating, especially to students, to try to do things virtually.
You mentioned some of the shifts that are happening in society. And, people, if nothing else, we tend to be resilient, we tend to adapt. And as you say, in the main, we've adapted very fast. How do you think people have adapted to change? And what have you seen in terms of how you have seen how people have adapted and experienced the changes that they've had to go through over the past 18, 24 months?
Well, there's the usual bell curve, Paul. And the thing that scares me the most is the huge number of people that want complicated topics to be reduced to bumper sticker simplicity. That's one of the things that we're seeing in the rise of totalitarianism the world over. So that's a very worrying counter trend. And it's part of the divide between people who are, sort of thoughtful, able to reinvent how they live and doing so to protect themselves and their families. What is particularly troubling is the way it has surfaced the huge degree of anti-science, anti-curious, anti-rational people, and the remarkable number of leaders and media sources that have risen up to capitalize on that, those misunderstandings, amplifying them and profiting off of them. I'm disheartened, to say the least, that we are having this moment in the, first third of the 21st century.
One wouldn't have expected to have to re-argue for democracy, for example. At these points in time, or face a global oligarchy that might be taking over. All these unintended consequences of many, many forces. I'm fascinated. You mentioned technology, and you also mentioned how we live in terms of what's changing. Do you have a view on some of the big changes in technology that you think are impacting us?
Well, of course. We've all learned to have high-speed internet. We've all learned to have a variety of tools available in the smartphones in our pockets that are quickly approximating supercomputers. There are many different trends there, Garrick, that I think are to be saluted and others that are to be sort of decried, right? So I'm not the first to say, but I agree with the sentiment that it's amazing that we since the mid-1980s, invested roughly $2 trillion in enhancing computing systems globally and another $1.5 trillion in advancing telecommunication systems globally. And what we got for that is a ridiculously large number of pictures of cats. And so it's possible to look at all of this and to see how right Neil Postman was when he pre-internet wrote the book with the astonishing title, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Mm. So at some level, Garrick, I worry that the normal way that people have adopted technology is as palliatives, as, you know, sort of something that allows them to live inside of a bubble, that allows them to reinforce the things that they already believe and to be not very curious about finding things that are truly new or truly challenging and inspiring and interesting. But again, it's such a divide because you also see the opposite. You see massive transformations of the pace of research, the speed with which we developed two separate mRNA vaccines, basically because of pre-existing innovations that are relatively recent but game-changing gene editing, Cas9 capabilities that won the Nobel Prize last year. I mean, it's just a beautiful time, Garrick, to see that divide.
So innovative. You know, taking ideas from one say and say, how can we apply this somewhere else? And that's happening so fast.
Yeah.
Say the pace of change is one. The only way this can all be worthwhile is if people's lives are impacted for the better. I mean, you and I were both recently at a think tank dealing with crypto and dealing with Bitcoin and decentralized finance. And it was amazing. I mean, I learned huge amounts of things.
One of the things that we both learned and helped others to learn, I hope, is that the velocity of adoption of decentralized finance, smart contracts, NFTs, decentralized finance technologies, all the crypto coins and the cryptocurrencies and the secure IDs, that the pace of adoption and adaptation is significantly higher than the original pace of adoption for the internet itself. So it doesn't take a wizard or a crystal ball to embrace the spirit of the podcast.
Yeah.
And say that one of the things that's going to happen now and next and soon is a radical shift to financial systems and services as we know it. And I think that's going to be thrilling.
I agree.
I think that there's going to be entirely new ways to fund artists and musicians and people trying to do small but important things.
Recently, Larry, you and I were at a conference on crypto and decentralized finance and Bitcoin and so on. And I have to say, I learned a huge amount, especially when I was considering, is this real? Is this going to last? And it became very clear to me that digital finance and digitally enabled finance is here to stay. It's going to redefine a huge amount. And I was especially impressed by those who were saying, yes, it takes a lot of computing power, but we are using sustainable methods to power this. And I was also impressed by not everybody who's into, you know, trying to make a buck, but there were people who were going, here are tangible ways that we can use Bitcoin for education, that we can use decentralized finance to finance homes and learning and food systems and so on. So it gives us options, which are amazing. What was your view?
Well, I spent 3 months every day getting ready for that conference, Garrick. I thought I knew a lot about decentralized finance, having helped several banks to modernize their infrastructure and prepare for it. And little did I realize that the velocity of adoption for decentralized finance is many times higher than the original velocity for the adoption of the internet itself. So it doesn't take a genius to project those trends forward in the spirit of your podcast and say that definitely one of the things that's coming is a revolution in the ways in which finance happens. And while it is true that it's carbon intensive in its computing systems, there are reasons why that's forcing people to reinvent data centers, which is exciting. But I'm, like you, particularly smitten by the way in which we can use non-fungible tokens and other new digital finance instruments to be able to find entirely new ways to fund, say, for instance, artists or writers or musicians, people that have often been left out of the opportunity engines of the world. And I think that's going to scare the heck out of most modern banks, but I also think it's going to revolutionize the way people have access to capital and all of the things that capital brings.
Larry, beyond finance, blockchain, as I understand it, it's going to likely have a huge impact across many, many sectors, and also into the metaverse or the virtual world, and this idea of buying NFTs that are not even, you know, just entirely in the virtual world. I saw you probably did Nike bought Artifact for some obscene amount of money for the ability to make trainers that you buy and wear in virtual reality. So on one hand, innovation and opening up, I imagine, huge new economies, but a massive change, and one that's probably going to affect us in society quite dramatically. And maybe, I wonder, pushing us more and more to work from home, to work remotely, to not actually coming to see each other at all. What's your view on some of that?
I think that the most interesting thing about modern information systems, Paul, is that we all have to expect a period of every possible trend being amplified for a while. So yes, there will be new ways to work from home, better ways to work from home, and different ways to create value in society, especially for, say, for instance, distributed groups of musicians that used to have to come together physically to do things. But I'm at least as interested, Paul, in the ways in which we can harness the power of smart contracts to revolutionize what happens on the basis of situations changing. So if a government was serious about using decentralized finance, they could automatically detect when somebody has been, you know, the victim of downsizing at work, automatically start to trigger their benefits, manage them all securely, give them direct payments or payments through a stored value card of some sort or another, and have all of that happen without any of us having to go stand in line, fill out forms, deal with, you know, dysfunctional governments that always seem to be decades behind where they ought to be in terms of agility. Equally interesting to me, Paul, and things that I'm personally working on, is a volunteerism platform that would allow people to volunteer to help each other out and to produce digital blockchain secure CVs proving their skills and their commitment to the community. I'm also working elsewhere in the world on a first ever totally negative carbon footprint ag sector for sheep farming, merino wool farming, and strong wool farming in New Zealand, because it's a country with the same population as the city of Chicago, but 10 times that many sheep. And so focusing on the sheep and transforming the whole sector is a wonderful way to get the future to show up somewhat ahead of its regularly scheduled arrival.
There's some amazing examples of how to use blockchain I hadn't even thought of. Larry, let me start with the first one. You talk about volunteering then and volunteerism. Tell us a little bit more about that. What's the problem that this approach solves?
Well, it was a couple of problems, as always, with modern platforms, Paul. They're always multi-sided ecosystems. So this one started when a church that does a lot of missionary work, famous for it, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was able to detect that there were fewer and fewer people at home for them to do their missionary work with. And as a result, the way they detected that, Paul, was through data. They discovered that their missionaries spread all over the world in 133 countries, I think, were getting more ill than ever before. And not from COVID. This was pre-COVID. This was 8 years ago. They discovered that the missionaries simply weren't able to have good and successful experiences. And they discovered that what was helping them to succeed more than anything was volunteer work. When they did something to build a community center or to build a preschool or to clean up a park or to do anything that local elected officials said were priorities. And so they built this great innovation called Just Serve, and I was privileged to help them plan it. But this year, 2021, we reinvented it around blockchain and people's mobile tools. So you can volunteer pretty much for any given moment about 24,000 things in the world. And it doesn't matter what church you come from. They are more than 60% of the volunteers are not from that church at all, unrelated to it. And increasingly, there are high school chapters all over the world, Paul, where high school kids are saying, we want to help our community. We want to establish a track record of doing things. At the university level, that's increasingly happening in Greek societies. For sports teams around the world, they're discovering that when they partner with Just Serve, they get this amazing set of volunteers to show up for anything, but highly motivated at the right time in the right place in the world and ready to do the work and expecting nothing in return.
Amazing.
And that's brand new. And it's now the world's largest volunteer platform. But blockchain and the technology that's been built inside of the cloud will allow it to be 100 to 1,000 times larger and not sink the church with operating costs. And that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to do it because it's the only way to make it affordable. Personally, I'm going to make you a reckless prediction, Paul, that 2 years from now, your record as a young person of your community service might be at least as important to a college admissions office as your test scores. And that will be because for the first time ever, there's a secure way to build a record. It will accurately reflect, and it's unhackable, what you've actually done and how many times you've been the leader of those efforts and how many people you've learned to direct and to support and to help to engage in terms of doing something that makes a difference. Plus, it's one of those marvelous antidotes to extreme weather problems. So when you have, as we've witnessed in the United States just last week, absolutely devastating tornado that scoured six states and created, you know, very rare in the month of December, hundreds of deaths. But volunteers always show up in the wake of those things. And isn't that a beautiful thing to be able to see how humans help other humans in times of adversity?
You're listening to What Now, the latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn.
I love that as a practical application of these new technologies where we're finding out how to make lives better for everyone. I really believe that's at the heart of so much of change always. I'd love to talk about your sheep before we find out some more reckless predictions that you might have. But how are you using the technology on the sheep side in New Zealand?
So for 160 years or so, the way wool fiber has been produced is with farmers distributed on little farms. They shear the sheep, they make bales of wool, they sell them to distributors and to brokers, most of whom, Garrick, are located not far from you in the UK. And those brokers and merchants have been the ones that have ultimately negotiated the wool prices the world over. And that has worked out fine for the brokers and merchants for a long time. But with smart contracts, you don't need to do that anymore. Now you can, as an individual sheep farmer, sell your wool for a predetermined price, distribute it to some place, have it tracked, graded, scoured, cleaned, spun into yarn, turned into deluxe garments, and shipped to you, Paul, or to you, Garrick, or to anybody that you want to give a holiday season gift to. And when that beautiful merino wool hoodie arrives to the happy recipient, there will be a smart tag on it. And when they scan that smart tag with their phone, they will find out exactly what farm grew that wool. And the next day, they will get a little baby lamb that has become assigned to them. They don't have any obligations. They don't have to read it stories at night. They don't have to feed it or pet it, but they will know what baby lamb has been assigned to them. And for the first time ever, there's a direct relationship between a farm that may be located, in your case, you know, 1,400 kilometers from you, and your beautiful final product, which you can care about and which is 100% recyclable, 100% stitched with solar looms, 100% traceable, to the exact farm that grew it, and 100% negative carbon footprint provably. And remember, Garrick, that there are five parts of how we live that are the most carbon intensive. And they are how we generate and distribute electricity itself, or power systems for that matter, agriculture, building systems, transportation systems, and manufacturing systems. And we won't be able to survive as a species unless we shift every one of those five carbon intensive parts of modern life to negative carbon footprint. And to have the number two most intensive carbon segment have a model for being regenerative, they call it, negative carbon footprint, soil healthy, all kinds of things that allow it to sustain itself for generations is thrilling for me. And one of the most important ways I've been able to focus my skills as an innovation scientist in my life.
May I just explore that a little bit? So what's fascinating about what not only the innovation and the blockchain technology, but also what I detect is using it as a model for a complete system that enables other systems to learn from it or enables other systems to model after it. Is that idea? It's like a proto, prototype.
It is, Garrick, and it's specifically not surprising with you. You've immediately moved to the systems level implication of a point innovation. Yes, we've figured out how to do it for sheep in New Zealand, but there are five agricultural sectors in New Zealand, right? There's dairy and there's other meat sectors, both beef and lamb and venison. There's fisheries, there's fruit production. Everybody's familiar with kiwi fruit, which predominantly comes from New Zealand. And there's forestry. And we've specifically designed this next generation agricultural system to be able to run the table and then to be licensable anywhere in the world. The last innovation that was really fundamental in agriculture was 71 years ago, Garrick. There's a guy named Norman Borlaug that, in my experience, nobody's ever heard of.
What was it? Nitrates? Was it large scale?
Well, it was actually remarkable condition tolerant wheat that he first engineered seeds that would be able to help deal with drought and cold and really bad growing conditions. And he did that with lots and lots of other crops. But then he created the Green Revolution, got a Nobel Prize for it.
The previous Green Revolution, which I came across in India.
Yes, not only did it have remarkable effects in Russia and Cuba and India and all over the world, but it provably saved nearly 2 billion lives. The way I like to teach this topic, Garrick, is as I pop up photos of leaders, Hitler and Pol Pot and Chairman Mao and Mussolini, and I ask people to tell me who these people are. And they can all name the folks that have killed millions of people in the world. And then I pop up a picture of Norman Borlaug and say, who's this dude? And nobody can recognize him. And he's the guy that saved 2 billion lives. And what does it say about humanity that we kind of know the despots, but we don't know the heroes, and especially the ones that made such a revolution? But look, we also have to see the dark side of Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution, monoclonal crops that are all the same, the huge industrial farming and everything.
Lack of diversity.
Yeah, and that's what has to be fixed. And it's really exciting to finally get around to fixing it. And we're seeing little fixes, but we're not yet seeing the massive ones. And those are coming. So in the spirit of your podcast, that's a big one that's coming. There are many others.
Larry, one of the things you said at the top of the show here was about how the large governing institutions and even government itself is often behind. And the way you describe smart contracts there, which can affect, by the sounds of everything, from finance to your benefits being automatically paid through how you volunteer, even to sheep and the supply chain around agriculture. What's going to be the need for these overseeing institutions that provide the rules and the frameworks and the control? And are we seeing anything where already the threat of smart contracts and blockchain is starting to cause ripples in some of these large institutions. Have you experienced any of that?
I have. I've experienced lots of things like that. So governments that don't start to move swiftly, Paul, are destined to become less relevant and even more frustrating to their citizens than they are historically, because people will have, as they do with Amazon or in other parts of the world, equally responsive, service-oriented organizations, people tend to get a new standard of expectations about what decent service means. And so governments are going to have to do this, but governments are also going to want to do it, Paul. And the reason is it's much cheaper than what they do now. It turns out that if you've got a smart contract system inside of a government, then you can ask every government agency to behave efficiently for them, which basically says, put your documents on this cloud with this shared digital backbone. Then you can use smart contracts to govern who has the right to access those documents. And that completely eliminates the part that's so frustrating, which is the having to go stand in line and show some right to be able to access a deed or a birth certificate, a death certificate, or a bill of sale, or get a driver's license issued. And instead, you can get all that to happen automatically according to the rules that the government actually cares about. And isn't that cool? I mean, it turns out that that's the efficient way to do it. The case I always teach, Paul, is Estonia, tiny little Estonia. And what they did to create the fastest digital revolution in the history of any government on planet Earth was so elementary. First, they already had digital identity cards for all citizens. Second, they created a single uniform required digital backbone for all government agencies to use. Now, what happens in such a case, every government agency comes along and says, oh, no, this one won't work for us. It doesn't do this or that or this other thing. To which the head of IT in Estonia respectfully said, I'm sorry, you're going to use it, and it's not optional, and we don't care about you being special. And then the third part of the revolution, which was the elegant and beautiful part, is they said, oh, and we neglected to mention, but next year your budget is going to be a function of whether or not the citizens have anything nice to say about some service you allow them to do now on the basis of their smartphones and their digital identity. And wow. So those simple things, specifically the zero-based budgeting, and your budget could be much higher or significantly lower, depending on whether or not the citizens were grateful for something you actually did on their behalf. I mean, it's so beautiful, Paul, and it's so simple. And I think that shows us a pathway forward for accelerating the adoption of things that are, frankly, hard and scary and complicated.
It's finding the right levers by the sounds of it, right?
That's exactly right. I often talk about that as an innovation scientist. How do you make innovation obligatory, not optional? And I think that is one of the greatest ways to think about it as a science and as a topic these days. Because, look, let's face it, all humans have a general tendency to avoid trying to do anything unfamiliar. And it's not because we're evil. It's not because we're incurious. It's just because we're familiar with something. It worked for us. It's gotten us to where we are. And so people tend to return things to the familiar every chance that they get. And that's one of the most important points of friction for anything new or interesting or important.
This conversation really makes me think about what's going on in the music industry, Larry, because mm-hmm. blockchain, you know, the thing about the music industry, which led the way, was the invention of PRS, or the performing rights systems, which allowed people who made music to earn from the IP of that as it was transmitted around the world and on radio and television and so on. Phenomenal innovation. Very, very difficult to manage, as you can imagine, because it requires
sure.
people being signing up to the platforms, paying subscriptions. Every radio has to submit what they're doing. Restaurants have to submit what's being played. Difficult. And what blockchain allows is for the tagging of music, so people can follow and know where it's being used on the systems. First one. The other amazing thing about the music we make today in this postmodern world is there's so much sampling and looping coming from existing music, or and every little piece of sample that is used in anything that is made, pop music or so on, the person who composed that has a right to earn from that. And what these new technologies allow us to do is all the way down, right at a 5-second sample or a 10-second sample, we are now able to track that piece and to make sure that monies will move through the systems back to the right people when required. And then you can extend that into legal contracts. You know, it gets to the point where you don't need legal contracts to be made up, because all the paragraphs which are tracked, if they put together into a system which are then enabled, if you like, you have a whole kind of metaverse which cuts out the middleman in many respects. So right. Paul was talking about government, talked about lawyers, accountants. It's going to change the way that we track stuff. And the thing we know about government is that 80% of the civil service are focused on tracking and tracking, making sure that things are done the way that the taxpayers expect them to be done, or just tracking forms and bureaucracy. So you can remove enormous amounts of that tracking because it can all be automated or built into the data. This was a big aha for me, is that they talked about the data being on the chain. I was like, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that every piece of data has another little piece of data that tells us something about where it's come from and where it's going. And when you have those two things traveling together, they can be recombined in any which way you want, as an innovation in any way. And yet you can also still make sense of where they came from, so we don't get, the snow cloud or the big gray goop that kills us. Do you think that's right? Am I seeing it?
I think it's not only right. I think it's one of the little understood consequences of modern life. When I was in high school, I wasn't great at math. I wasn't interested in math. And I was one of those particularly insufferable students that would force my professor to tell me why I needed, to understand advanced calculus. And he would say, well, this is how we, calculate the trajectory of a missile. And I said, well, I have no current plans to send off any missiles, so I'm not really that interested in calculating its trajectory, but I'm glad someone knows how to do that. So I had all kinds of reasonable sounding reasons why I could maintain my ignorance. And imagine my surprise, Garrick, when I grew up and realized how central math is to modern life, predictive analytics, tracking and auditing of just about everything. And then I ended up, through no fault of my own, having my firm purchased by Deloitte, the world's largest services firm and one of the four remaining auditing firms in the world. So one of the things that fascinated me, Garrick, was when I was asked to do the future of audits for the world's largest audit firm. And it took us about 3 months to create more than 100 innovations and audits. But one of the things I learned along the way is the structural reason why there's only 4 audit firms left in the world. Do you have any idea why that would be?
No, please tell.
It turns out that you can't audit the books of any large-scale enterprise in anything close to reasonable amounts of time unless you do it all entirely digitally. So if a huge company, let's say General Motors or Google, closes the books for a month or a quarter or a year, their auditors will know within an hour of the end of that period where there are difficulties. They won't know necessarily exactly what the difficulty is, but they'll be able to say, over here in this manufacturing plant in Saline, Michigan, you appear to have someone on the take because the numbers are out of whack. And then they can focus and find what the nature of the problem is. You can't do that without huge amounts of data. But what you're pointing to is the next wave that's coming, which is that everything we produce and all the ways that it creates an economy with lots and lots of participants who have historically been left out of the festivities, can now participate automatically and be fairly included and properly compensated. Moreover, Garrick, and this is something that, again, didn't really make as much sense to me until very recently, let's say that you are a composer and you've got a significant other and you've got a series of relationships and maybe some children that are dependent on your income. And then you go through a life event, a divorce or a death in the family or something else, to have all of those rights not have to go into a court for months and months, but have them all automatically managed by these smart contracts so that, you know, there's no disruption, there's no lack of fairness, there's no sneakiness, there's no need for the courts to be clogged for years while somebody tries to figure out what the new strategy has to be with that stream of payments. This is just, you know that lovely old phrase that a sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, from the science fiction writer. And that's what we're getting to. We're getting to a point where extraordinarily complicated things can be managed en passant with no extra effort, just because it's designed into the data streams.
Larry, I've loved this conversation with you, and we're approaching the end of our time together. But you mentioned earlier, you gave us one of your ridiculous predictions. And I wondered if you had any more ridiculous predictions that you could share with our listeners.
Oh, sure. Here's one that I think is inevitable. I think we've reached the time when the destruction wreaked by disinformation systems that are amplified with greater efficiency than disciplined information systems is so obviously harmful that we're going to have to get to a point in time where the entire internet is audited in real time to be able to determine which things are opinion, which things are true-ish, and which things are not true. And I think that that's technologically feasible. I've had my graduate students working on it, Paul, and we've got the algorithms cracked to be able to do that in real time. But it will require a huge shift, and it'll be similar to the way in which financial reports from publicly traded companies used to just have good practices that were recommended, and then by law, they had to be audited. I think we're going to get to the same place with most of the stuff on the internet.
Yeah, it's going to be inbuilt, isn't it? It would be nice to know where that quote came from. You know what I'm saying? When you find a stat which tells you about some awful scenario, which reinforces perhaps somebody else's political opinion. It would be nice to know where that comes from. I saw a horrible article which said that Facebook had been doing some auditing and there were a very limited number of accounts, I think it was 70 or something, which were the basis for a lot of the fake news that had been coming out. So it wasn't very, it wasn't enormous at all. But as soon as you were able to track it back, you were able to deal with the sort of viral impact of things that are, not true.
Yeah. And that's what my students were able to focus on, Garrick, is exactly that. It turns out that there are extremely easily identified patterns about the velocity and the dispersion patterns of disinformation. It's also interesting to see how it's what people click on the most. It's the most interesting stuff that shows up in their in-basket. And so
if it bleeds, it leaves.
Precisely. And once those 70 or so primary feeders of the disinformation start something, at that point, it becomes self-reinforcing. And the evidence is quite clear that the bad actors are doing that in part to disrupt any participative democracy anywhere in the world, simply by finding the things that annoy both of the poles in any part of society, you know, the right and the left, and then feeding lots of disinformation. So we have to fix that. That's one of the things that would be lovely to fix. And to me, it should always be opt-in in the sense that there should just be a little flag in the upper right-hand corner of any window you're looking at that allows you to see whether it's, you know, red, yellow, green, or purple to indicate that it's an opinion about something or other. And I think that that is both doable and urgently needed. But back to your question, Paul, I think we're also going to have to see an incredibly interesting time of incentivizing behaviors that are more sustainable in the world. I think that there's going to be all kinds of new mechanisms to reward people, Garrick, much in the spirit you already identified, as having happened historically with music, so that people that create advances in better ways to live, and those can be in lots of ways, quality of life, sustainability issues, even great and popular recipes can start to get rewarded for their contributions and acknowledged for the things that they're doing that are in the spirit of helping others. I also think there's going to be an amazing revolution in education, which will stop being mostly about degrees and start being about dynamic certifications for things that people want to be able to become skilled at, and real world experiential evidence that they've mastered those topics. I think there's going to be a revolution in research and how we fund it, how we direct it, and how we stop having the huge emphasis on specialization and start having new and sophisticated degrees of integration across specialties. I think there's going to be a revolution in the oceans and in how we manage them and how we make them healthier. And I think there's going to be a huge revolution in how we do climate engineering and eco-engineering at a large scale. Those are a handful. There are more.
Just a few. Just a few. But you cover such a broad range of ideas and how you connect those ideas together. It's remarkable.
You make me feel like it's doable. That's the thing, Larry.
It is doable. It's not only doable, it's urgent. It's now, here's one of the things that's a comfort to me. We've had a fairly dark conversation, especially at the beginning, about what a bleak moment we're in as a species. And it's easy to focus on the things that are really devastatingly wrong with modern society, people's incuriosity, their lack of attention span. But you know what's so interesting is in the history of our species, every time we've actually needed things, the innovation patterns have risen to those challenges. We are really good at adapting to times of extraordinary change. There was a remarkable book written in the 1980s by Alvin Toffler, famous futurist, called Future Shock, where he basically said, oh my God, the pace of modern life is so great that humans can no longer adapt, and we're going to hell in a handcart, and there's going to be dogs and cats living together, and a real breakdown of society and wrath of God type stuff. And it was a really dark book. And my great mentor, Jay Doblin, was on a national, you know, debating tour with Alvin Toffler. And it was hilarious because Jay was hilarious. And he would be in a Commonwealth Club of San Francisco with Alvin Toffler, and Alvin would say his piece from his book, and Jay would say, oh, Alvin, this is terrible. This is scary. But let's just check in. I mean, where are you now? He says, I'm in San Francisco. And he would say, well, where were you yesterday? And say, well, I was in Boston. He says, oh my God, man, you must be exhausted having, you know, come 3,000 miles and you must be just famished and dehydrated. And no, I'm fine. They fed me okay. It was first class airplane seat, and I had plenty of water, and I'm comfortable. I had a nice hotel. Surely this wrenching change in climate must be difficult to adapt to. And we keep showing Alvin that, you know, no one anticipated modern air travel. No one anticipated the kinds of healthcare systems that we had at that stage. And that's the thing, Garrick, is humans are a little bit lazy. We wait till there's an acute need to invent something that's urgently needed. But then we rise to the occasion. And so I expect that the astonishments that we have seen, many of them ushered in or accelerated by COVID, will become permanent. And many other things that we need even more urgently because the planet and the populace is threatened by their lack will come along in ways that we can scarcely anticipate. You know, just the revolutions coming behind CRISPR and electrified transportation and electrification of the grid and the way to store energy are going to be beautiful and important and game-changing for all of us.
Thank you, Larry. That was fantastic.
Wow, Larry, I mean, amazing insights. And it's such a pleasure and so thought-provoking to have a conversation with you about everything from society, but smart contracts, from volunteering to sheep, to the future, to the grid. It's been a wonderful conversation. We are really grateful for you joining us today.
Well, I'm grateful to the two of you for trying to have a real conversation about things that matter, because I don't have the vaguest idea what's going to happen next to the Kardashians. So I'm off the end of my union card there, but I'm really happy to have a conversation about what's next for our species and our planet that matters, gentlemen. And thank you for setting the conditions so that we can have such a conversation today.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for listening to the What Now? Ludic Insights podcast. What now from you? If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a What Now conversation. Remember, we're asking the big questions about what we should be doing, how we should achieve these, and what are some of the weak signals that already exist that may show the way forward. What now? If you're interested in submitting questions, please do so by pinging us directly at our LinkedIn page on the Ludic Podcast What Now page. And you can submit names of interesting people and projects that you believe we should feature on this podcast. We'd be delighted if you join the conversation. Hashtag What Now Ludic Insights. What now? Subscribe today and stay tuned. See you next time.
That's a wrap for this episode of What Now, part of the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn. Stay tuned for more and subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, CastBox, iHeart, Listen Notes, Overcast, Podchaser, and Radio Public. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and Jill Damatek-Futter and edited by Jill Damatek-Futter and Roman Pacherski.